they tend to kind of take a step back from the major concession down the line. It's their typical negotiation tactic.
North Korea says a peace treaty is not enough to denuclearize. It's Wednesday, October 3rd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, Indonesia's tsunami death toll rises. Navigating virtual Singapore. New clothes from old in Hong Kong. Aging wine underwater. And the newest cars on display in Paris. It's all on today's VOA Asia. South Korea's unification minister told lawmakers Tuesday he believes North Korea may have up to 60 nuclear bombs. At the same time, the North's state-run KCNA news agency said the U.S. is demanding too much and offering too few concessions in trying to get Pyongyang to denuclearize. The Korean Central News Agency said an end-of-war declaration can never be a bargaining chip for getting the DPRK to denuclearize. And the commentary suggested an end to international sanctions in exchange for what it called the North's substantial and crucial steps to implement the joint statement that emerged from June's U.S.-North Korea summit. Go Myung-hyun is a research associate at the Seoul-based Asan Institute for Policy Studies, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty the unification minister's estimate of nuclear weapons appears to be in line with one released by the United States last year.
I think last year the Defense Intelligence Agency estimated that North Korea possessed around 60 nuclear warheads. So clearly South Korean estimate is within the range of the estimation, I would say. So in that sense, it's not really completely out of line.
Any idea why he released this information today?
I think it's at the request of probably local media inquiries. Basically, probably what happened was that the local media probably got wind of the National Intelligence Service testimony about the number of nuclear warheads that, in their estimation, North Korea possesses. So the local media wanted to confirm that with a different source, this time being the Minister of Unification.
The North Korean official news agency on Tuesday said a declaration ending the Korean War should not be seen as a bargaining chip in denuclearization talks, but suggested lifting sanctions might be. What do you make of that?
This is not really also not our line when it comes to North Korea's typical diplomatic tactic. We know that what North Korea proposes what looks like a major concession, but they tend to kind of take a step back from the major concession down the line. It's their typical negotiation tactic. We have seen that with the Singapore summit before the summit took place. It sounded like North Korea is committed to complete nuclearization, but when the United States seemed like it was agreeing to the idea of having the summit with Kim Jong-un, North Korea backed off from committing fully to denuclearization. So we are seeing the same pattern here. Kim Jong-un, during the inter-Korean summit in Pyongyang last month, he stated that he would like to shut down the Yongbyon nuclear facility if the United States took corresponding measures, which was widely interpreted in outside of North Korea as referring to signing of the declaration to end the war. So I think North Korea is now aware that this negotiation quid pro quo has taken hold in both Seoul and Washington. So it has become a baseline American negotiation position at the moment. Then I think North Korea is trying to take advantage of that by saying that if the United States wants that, wants to shut down the Yongbyon nuclear facility, then now we need an additional concession from you guys. I think this is what the North Koreans are doing right now.
Last week at the United Nations, North Korean foreign minister said his government will never give up its nuclear weapons unilaterally before Washington proves its willingness to take corresponding steps. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. Indonesia's tsunami death toll jumps to more than 1,200. Humanitarian agencies speed aid to earthquake victims in Indonesia. North Korea rejects idea of peace treaty in exchange for denuclearization. Cambodia accused Vietnam of systematic logging fraud. China's private enterprises feel squeeze on all fronts. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. United Nations and international agencies are on the ground and more are en route to help victims of the earthquake and tsunami in Sulawesi, Indonesia. Latest official government figures put the number of deaths at more than 1,200, with 800 seriously injured and nearly 100 missing. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the UN European headquarters in Geneva.
The United Nations estimates 66,000 houses have been damaged and nearly 62,000 people made homeless by the 7.4 magnitude earthquake that struck Sulawesi on Friday. UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs spokesman Jens Lajerke says thousands of people are unable to return to their damaged or destroyed homes. Many fearful, terrified survivors are sleeping in the open as aftershocks of the devastating quake continue.
There have been numerous land and mudslides, leaving many affected communities cut off. As a result, there's still limited information about the full extent of the disaster, and it is difficult to get aid and people into the affected areas.
The International Red Cross Federation reports more than 175 volunteers and staff from the Indonesian Red Cross are conducting search and rescue activities. IFRC spokesman Matthew Cochran says the local Red Cross is setting up a health clinic in one of the affected areas to provide basic services to the survivors.
They're seeing a lot of bruises and fractures and open wounds, things that you often see after an earthquake. They're also beginning to see issues related to inadequate access to food and clean water, so diarrhea, stomach issues.
This is the sixth fatal tsunami to strike the country since the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. That horrific event killed more than 250,000 people in 12 countries, the vast majority in Indonesia. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The recent string of natural disasters have exacted a severe toll in both economic damage and human lives throughout Asia. The UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction, or UNISDR, says up to 1.6 million people could be affected by the earthquake and tsunami. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked UNISDR spokesman Dennis McLean about what his agency is doing to keep people who live in the area safer in the future.
This earthquake and tsunami that happened last Friday is a reminder that the Pacific Ring of Fire is the most dangerous and most active seismic zone in the world. In fact, 90% of the world's earthquakes occur around that circumference of the Pacific. And we have seen since the Indian Ocean tsunami in 2004 that Indonesia has suffered about six or seven tsunamis which have resulted in loss of life.
What is the goal of this? Is it to get the people to move out of the area? It is people to be aware or beware? You know, what is the purpose?
Well, we saw that in the in this latest earthquake and tsunami that there was a very short interval between the earthquake and the arrival of the tsunami waves. And we saw also from TV footage that a lot of people were still in the vicinity of the coastline when they should have immediately evacuated to higher ground as soon as the earthquake was felt. That's an indication that we have still have a lot more work to do in terms of raising public awareness of the danger of tsunamis. Tsunamis kill more people than any other natural hazard, even if they are rather rare.
So what is the next step?
Well, the next step is to continue educating the general public living in coastlines that are exposed to tsunamis and earthquakes. And for this reason, the UN 3 years ago established November the 5th as World Tsunami Awareness Day. So that's an occasion every year when we do try to mobilize UN member states, local governments, and other partners to, you know, take action to create forums for discussion of tsunami risks, to encourage the general public to engage in training drills, evacuation exercises, and just generally to ensure that people of all ages are aware of the threat, and that the simplest thing to do when you're living on a coastline which is exposed to a tsunami threat, as soon as an earthquake happens, you immediately evacuate to higher ground and you remain there until the danger has passed.
What about people who already live there? Is there any effort to get them to move if they could?
There certainly is. I mean, after the Indian Ocean tsunami, a tsunami early warning system was introduced in the Indian Ocean. There already was one in the Pacific Ocean for over 50 years. And through these systems, many governments are now able to send texts directly to people's mobile phones. They can raise the alarm through sirens, you know, through media, etc. There are many ways of getting the message across to people. But the key element of all this is ensuring that the public know what to do when they do receive an alert, that they know what evacuation routes to take, they know where to go, where they will be safe. And it's very important that this kind of education is undertaken in the schools, particularly.
Was this report in the works before this happened in Indonesia?
Yeah, well, we just issued a press announcement, you know, drawing attention to the fact that the Pacific Ring of Fire is the most active seismic zone on the planet and requires special attention when it comes to disaster risk management. You know, we're issuing a report next week which highlights the fact that more people die in earthquakes and tsunamis than from any other natural hazard. You know, over the last 20 years, 747,000 people have lost their life in earthquakes and tsunamis. And we should never forget that, even if, you know, a lot of attention these days is focused on extreme weather events. Nonetheless, it's the case that earthquakes and tsunamis do cause more loss of life than any other natural hazard.
Said such disasters tend to hurt the poorest people in the poorest countries most severely. Dennis McLean spoke with VOA Asia from Geneva via Skype. Happening now in Asia, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is expected to keep key ministers in their posts in a cabinet reshuffle, including finance, foreign affairs, and the economy minister, who has handled knotty trade talks with the United States. Abe's reshuffle appeared to focus on stability. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Imagine seeing an incredibly detailed map of your home city in three dimensions. You can in Singapore, where city planners are considering how new technology may help improve life while trying to protect very revealing personal data and details. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
This is Virtual Singapore, a detailed map of the city that carries a stunning amount of granular data, from details about how much square footage there is in an individual building to how much sunlight pours through a window on a normal day. The 3D map, part of Singapore's Smart Nation plan, was created by the French company Dassault Systèmes. The goal of the project was to pack as much data into the map as technically possible.
The first thing is that cities are coming and where they're looking to the world as a flat world. When you look in the digital view of the cities, they are looking to 2D layers of data. So you can have geospatial information, you can have static information. All those must be reconciled in a consistent model.
The visual clarity and detail of the map are stunning, but the practical applications are so broad that Singapore officials like George Low are just starting to understand what this program is capable of.
So we could analyze which areas are prone to flooding in during heavy rainfalls, or we could use the same platform to analyze in different precincts how we could add in measures to allow the airflow in within the precincts to cool down the precinct in hot weather.
The program also has the ability to add in real people using the tracking information from their cell phones. And this could help city planners dealing with issues such as how to move people from one place to another quickly, say during an emergency evacuation. But tracking all those people without their consent presents a huge security and privacy issue, one that Lowe says his team is taking seriously.
We need to look in some measures to ensure privacy is maintained. We will not infringe the privacy policy of Singapore.
But the creators of the map hope that working with this much detail will help them plan and simulate a safe and citizen-friendly Singapore years into the future. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Coming up, Hong Kong aims to make old clothes new. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. a way to learn American English, and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia. Desperation and frustration is rising on the central Indonesian island of Sulawesi, where more than 1,200 people were killed in last week's devastating earthquake and tsunami. Many residents in Palu are looting abandoned stores in a search for food and clean water. VOA Asia Facebook has the story as it develops. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, recycling clothing and other textiles, and a record price for Asian art are the stories on this week's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
In Hong Kong, a more than 1,700 square meter recycling textile mill will go into operation this month. It's part of a new wave of eco-conscious fashion consumerism that seeks to reduce waste and help the environment. Christina Dean is the founder of Redress.
I think that consumers have become overwhelmed with so many options for so many clothes, and after so many years of consuming fashion this way, many people are turning their backs on that just to say enough is enough.
Hong Kong alone sends 343 tons of textiles to the city's landfills every day. Since mainland China recently banned the import of solid waste, including textile scraps, the city has come under pressure to find new ways of dealing with its trash. The new recycling mill, developed by the Hong Kong Research Institute for Textiles and Apparel, will sterilize, sort, and turn textiles into fresh fiber, processing 3 tons of textile waste a day. Other telltale signs of the growing sustainable fashion movement, clothes mending workshops, pop-up swap events, and designers using recycled fabrics. Fashion clinic designer Kay Wong.
In the current era, fast fashion makes people dispose of their clothes so easily because clothes are too cheap, and it seems to cost nothing to toss out the old ones. Fashion clinic hopes to encourage people to treasure what they have, as the resources on Earth are limited.
In early September, Hong Kong's government also funded a 2-day fashion summit, widely touted as the largest sustainable fashion event in Asia. An abstract oil painting by Chinese artist Zhao Wuqi has sold for over $65 million at Sotheby's auction house in Hong Kong. Harry Dalmeny is the UK chairman for Sotheby's.
I believe that establishes a new world record for that artist, and indeed a new world record for an oil painting by any Asian artist at auction, and it is indeed the most valuable painting sold by any auction house in Hong Kong.
The 33-foot triptych was originally commissioned by architect I.M. Pei for a complex called Raffles City in downtown Singapore. The work is considered to be emblematic of Wu Qi's infinity period. It was last bought by Taiwanese businessman Chang Chuo-dun, who paid $2.3 million for the piece in May 2005, giving him a huge return on his investment. Sotheby's has declined to identify the buyer, who placed the winning bid by phone in Hong Kong on Sunday. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia. Cambodia has asked Interpol to investigate allegations that Vietnam has repeatedly and knowingly accepted fraudulent permits for endangered luxury timber that is illegally logged. Stocks of expensive Siamese rosewood have been decimated along Cambodia's border with Vietnam. You'll find free stockpiles of stories every day at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, traditional two-handed ceramic jars, known as amphoras, were used extensively in ancient Greece to store and transport a variety of products, especially wine. These days, they are more likely to be found in shipwrecks than in stores. But wine-filled amphoras are once again being found on the seafloor. Not from sunken ships, but more deliberately placed there by a special Eastern European winery. Faith Lapidus uncorks the story.
Like other wineries, Edivo in Drace, Croatia, has a special cellar for aging wine. But owner Ivo Shegovic says he and his partner began aging their wine in an underwater cellar in the Adriatic about 10 years ago.
We do it at a depth of 20 meters because in the Bay of Mali Stone, here we have a year-round temperature of 15 degrees Celsius at that depth. And that is perfect for aging red wine.
In fact, Shegovic says, the product was much better than wine aged in the cellar.
But the only thing we were still missing was darkness. So we thought about ways to store wine underwater, in the dark, because at 20 meters there is still light coming through. So we came up with the idea of using amphoras. When we put a glass bottle inside an amphora, light is blocked from reaching the wine.
The wine is named Navis Mysterium, or Sea Mystery. It's made from a local grape and is kept on the seafloor for almost 2 years. The wine will be aged a total of 3 years before it's ready to be sold, still in its protective clay amphora. Sommelier Darko Dabic says Mysterium has a different character than Edivo's other wines.
The main difference between these two wines is actually just because of the reason of aging, is that this one is a little bit more smoother and rounded.
Next year, Edivo will start offering its guests a chance to dive alongside winery staff to select the right wine to accompany their meal. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
2018 marks the 120th year of the world-famous Paris Auto Show. Car manufacturers parade their products, which have dramatically changed through the years in response to, among other things, rising oil prices and climate change. VOA's Arash Erbasadi tells us even women's participation has evolved from objectified accessories to full-fledged participants.
For more than a century, the Paris Auto Show has been the place for car enthusiasts and manufacturers. Cars like General Motors' Firebird, Renault's Frégate, Jaguars, and of course Mercedes-Benz showcase cutting-edge technology for the times.
There was a type of Silicon Valley in West Paris. There were a lot of manufacturers competing in innovation to offer Parisians a fashionable, very expensive object, which will gradually become a lifestyle and would enter the daily lives of individuals, thanks to the auto show.
The first Paris Auto Show in 1898 drew about 140,000 visitors. By 1954, that number hit 1 million. Manufacturers from around the world took notice and showcased their car's special features, from trunk space to the torpedo-like grille of the Oldsmobile Golden Rocket. But in response to soaring oil prices in the 1970s, car companies adapted output to boost a slumping automobile industry.
What we see in particular, for example, in this first decade of the automobile industry crisis, brought about by high oil prices, was the reduction in size of the vehicles. It was a way to urbanize the vehicle. From this point on, the car becomes integrated in the city.
International car shows had long been criticized for their objectification of women. Over time, the auto industry began targeting women as consumers and not just as hood ornaments.
Women are drivers. The role of women is not just to put cars in the spotlight.
In recent years, the Paris Auto Show has drawn 1.4 million visitors. This year's show runs from October 4th to the 14th. Arash Erbasadi, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us on VOA Asia Facebook every day as we stream our program, and you can also hear us on our website, voanews.com. We, of course, are broadcast on many great radio stations around Asia, like DZUP, 1602 AM Radio, at the University of the Philippines, Diliman in Quezon City. Thanks to everybody who's tuned in today. And we thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Kelvin Fowler, managing editor Diane Gao, and our great VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a terrific day.